so much better all the time. It's getting better all the time.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the music show the Beatles historian Mark Lewis. And last time we spoke to him, the first volume of his three-volume history, The Beatles All These Years, had come out. It was called Tune In. And even though it was a huge book, it took us as far as the recording of the Beatles' first album. So we're probably going to have to wait quite a while until we get to the bit of The Beatles All These Years that deals with Sergeant Pepper, but fortunately we have Mark here now to talk about Sergeant Pepper. You're a year younger than me, I noticed, so you were sentient when Sergeant Pepper was released, and I wonder what you remember. What was the first that you heard of Sergeant Pepper?
I was a Beatles fan. I was born in 1958, so I was 9 when the record came out. I remember hearing about it. I don't exactly recall how I first knew of it, but and I didn't get it straight away. But quite soon after its release, I saved up the money to buy it. I had been buying the occasional 45, the occasional single, until that time. And this was something, an LP, it was obviously much more expensive, and for a child, you know, quite prohibitively so. But I knew I had to have it. And when eventually I did get it, which I think was probably about 3 or 4 months after its release, it was quite simply the most magical artifact that I'd ever held in my life. The music was completely intoxicating. It was so exciting. It was so original. It was so vibrant and colorful. But beyond that was the fact that it was this beautiful package, this extraordinary front cover design, and then you open it up to a gatefold, and then on the back cover were the words. The entire thing was magical. And I would sit cross-legged on the floor in front of our little mono gramophone player, listening to the music and just holding the cover, because they belonged together. It wasn't just a cover that you'd put on the side whilst you listened to the record. You had to have the whole experience. And from that point on, at the age of 9, I was caught up in it.
The Beatles tended to keep their singles and their albums separate anyway, although there was a little overlap. But Sgt. Pepper had no singles.
The Beatles were always reluctant to include singles on albums, and although once or twice it had been necessary to do that, for the most part their albums did not include them. So they were careful to keep the two things separate. They didn't want to be criticized for making people buy the same thing twice. And they remembered their own experiences. Paul particularly remembered buying records in the late 1950s with, you know, what little money he had and had saved up. This is, you know, well before they were wealthy and successful. And the horrible feeling he was left with when he felt ripped off, that what he had bought was not quite what he had thought he bought. And they were always keen to ensure that that couldn't be held against them. And it wasn't only them. That was generally the nature of the business in those days. Singles and albums were kind of separate entities. That changed drastically in the 1970s and 80s when albums such as, for example, Thriller by Michael Jackson would be milked for its singles, and it would just be any possible way of making more cash from it would be explored. But the Beatles put out Sgt. Pepper, did not take a single from it. They put out the White Album a year later, 30 tracks, 2 discs, no singles from it. So it was a different mindset in those days.
We should talk about the back of the sleeve. Everybody talks about the front of the sleeve, but the back seems to me much more significant in the long run, because Sgt. Pepper was the first album to publish its song lyrics, and it suggests that the Beatles themselves knew that there was something significant about the album and about the way in which people would treat it as an artifact, to use your word, and would sit down and look at it and would be sitting down and listening to the music rather than getting up and dancing to it.
Yes, that's right. It's so easy now to just think, well, there are the words on the back cover, but there had not been an album that had the words on the cover like this. That's a sweeping statement to say. In my job as a historian, I'm looking to be certain of myself when I say such things, and I've yet to find any other album that preceded it that had the words. If anybody listening to this knows better, please get in touch. everything about Pepper was quality and a step up from anything they had done before. And that was a conscious move on their part.
You're listening to The Music Show on RM. We're talking about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is 50 years old. And we're talking to Mark Lewison, who is a Beatles historian. Some would say the Beatles historian and the author of The Beatles All These Years, of which we so far have only volume one. Let's talk about A Day in the Life, because it's, I suppose, the most celebrated song on Sgt. Pepper. And you were talking about everything about the album being a step up, and this is several steps up in many ways, not least because it finds Paul McCartney standing on a podium conducting a 40-piece orchestra.
They realised that anything was possible. The studio had become a workshop for them. They had loved recording from the moment they first went into the studio, but by this time, they had time on their hands because they were not touring anymore, so there was no pressure to finish this by a certain date because we've got to go out on the road. And also, they were not paying for their studio costs. It was part of one of the beneficial elements of their recording contract with EMI was that they didn't have to pay session time. So they could just spend as long as they liked. And EMI was not going to tell them to hurry up because everything they produced was selling by the millions. So it was really in their interest to let them do what they needed to do. And this was also a time of a great extension of their own personal interests and fascination for other forms of music and whatever the possibilities you could use with recording tape. So A Day in the Life is the logical extension of all of that. It's both in its composition. It's quite a shattering song to listen to because of the word content, the lyrics, and also because of the way that it's sung by John Lennon. An extraordinary section written by Paul, which has been slotted into the middle of it seamlessly. And then these two great orchestral crescendos, one in the middle of the song and one at the very end, which was basically, I'm sure everyone listening to it knows it. It's the sound of an orchestra, 41-piece orchestra playing from the musicians playing from the lowest note on their respective instruments to their highest in a given number of bars, I think 24 bars. Pop music had always been I Love You and You Love Me and Will You Love Me Tomorrow and Why Did My Baby Leave Me and all of that. No one had ever heard anything like this before because nothing like this had ever been done. 50 years on, there isn't much that hasn't been done. But when you're listening to this, you need to try and take yourself back to 50 years ago and realize what this would have sounded like to people who had never heard anything like it before.
They were able to take, I think it was 129 days to make this album compared to the 10 hours which they spent on their first album only, 4.5, 5 years earlier. But
yes,
what's interesting in Day in the Life, because as you say, it's radically different from anything that had gone before. It was when they started work on it, they didn't know how it was going to go. They left these gaps for something to happen, these 24
yes.
bars, but they didn't know what was going to be in the 24 bars, so they just had somebody counting.
Yes, they had Mel Evans, who was their roadie, humping their equipment around and, you know, going off to buy food or socks or whatever they needed. He was their gopher, and they had him just count out the bars. It's a stunning piece of work. You mentioned there yourself 4.5 to 5 years since they had first gone into the studio and made their first record, their first album. How to get from that to this is what's so tremendously awe-inspiring still about the Beatles' progression, how their own actual artistic progression, how it moved so incredibly fast. The consequence of admiring the speed of that revolution is often that the early material seems primitive by comparison. But actually, in its own time, the Beatles' earliest recordings were were almost as revolutionary as Sgt. Pepper was in 1967, but they took the audience with them on their journey.
I read the news today, oh boy. 4,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. And though the holes were rather small, they had to count them all. Now they know how many holes it takes to fill the album.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN, and I'm talking to Mark Lewison, who is the Beatles chronicler in many ways. He's the author of the three-volume history, The Beatles All These Years, of which we've so far got volume one. And before that, he wrote The Complete Beatles Recording Sessions, where you can find out exactly what happened in the studio day by day, pretty much. And reading about Sgt. Pepper, Mark, is fascinating in that book, not least because you really understand to what extent it was driven by Paul. It was the concept of the album was Paul's, and he's really pulling everyone together, and they are still all pulling in the same direction, even if he's leading the way when they make this album.
Yes, I think of it as, I think when you really look at, you know, exactly what happened in each of the sessions and the overall artistic direction that this project had, Paul was definitely driving the bus, followed quite closely by John. I do see this very much as a joint enterprise between them. Ringo's on the album, of course, every track, and extraordinarily good drumming as well. But he ended up preferring other Beatles albums because this one, unlike any other album they made, was done in a kind of piecemeal way. They would lay down the basic tracks. Yes, that was often a live enterprise where the four of them would be in the studio cutting the rhythm track. But all the embellishments, the vocal embellishments, and also the other musical invention that was on this album was often done in overdubs, and Ringo didn't necessarily have much of an involvement in that. And he has this line as something like, I learned to play chess on Sgt. Pepper because there was a lot of time of sitting off to the side, or even not needing to be there at all, because they had done the basic track and now they were just doing the frills on top. And George was not as involved in Sgt. Pepper as he was in the other Beatles albums, partly for the reason I just gave, and also because at this time his main interest was not the guitar, it was the sitar. And he adds his Indian instruments to two or three or four of the tracks on the album, but really he only has to himself one track, which is Within You, Without You. So again, though he is on the basic tracks, and he's on every track, well, She's Leaving Home, where none of the Beatles play instrumentally, but George was less involved with Pepper than he was with Revolver and, say, the White Album, which were either side of Sgt. Pepper. And therefore, it was not his favourite Beatles album either. It really is a McCartney or McCartney-Lennon enterprise, Sgt. Pepper, when you look at it in its totality. But they always had been the driving force within the foursome, because they were the songwriters. So there was nothing too different there other than the fact that because a lot of it was piecemeal, once the basic tracks were done, it was mostly the two of them.
And you find that the more you look at it, the more you listen to it, there's quite a lot of collaboration between them on this album. I mean, it's true to say that you can, generally speaking, say, well, that's obviously a Paul song and that's obviously a John song. But even a song as John-like as Day in the Life has that middle bit by Paul, and it's Paul's idea to bring in the orchestra and have them do that 24-bar improvisation from their lowest to their highest note. So that,
yes,
which is pretty significant contribution to the song.
Paul was absolutely on top of the game at this time in his life. He was utterly in command of his talents and so free with his thinking. He's actually on the album more than you'd think, in the sense of the songs that appear to be strongly John Lennon songs, like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds or Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. Actually, Paul was involved in the writing of those, because what they were still doing at this time, and it was coming to an end, this phase, each one of them would take his song idea to the other, because as Paul has said in a number of interviews, coming up with the melody line is obviously one person will come up with the melody line and the idea for the song and maybe the first verse, but after that you possibly get stuck. You're not necessarily going to write the whole 3-minute song in one sitting. So they were still in the habit of taking their songs to one another and say, I've got this song, here's how it starts, here's how I see the first half a minute of it, what should we do next? And so Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which was very much a John Lennon song in its conception and its vision, definitely had a lot of Paul McCartney input in the composing.
Yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
And this is The Music Show on RN, and we're talking about Sgt. Pepper today. It's the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and I'm talking to Beatles historian Mark Lewis, and we're talking about the way in which Lennon and McCartney still collaborated around this time. One of the songs on Sgt. Pepper, which is very much a Paul song, a gorgeous, tuneful waltz, in fact, has a significant contribution from John Lennon, and that She's Leaving Home.
She's Leaving Home is one of those rare Beatles tracks on which there's none of them are playing, because it's only the little ensemble that they put together to play the instruments. But John was involved in helping Paul write the lyrics, and I think probably the point you're driving at is the extraordinary vocals that the vocal contribution that John makes, where he becomes the voice of the parents, the angst-ridden parents whose daughter has left home. A masterful idea to actually not just write the song from the girl's point of view, or in fact, it's actually written from the point of view of a commentator observing the girl leaving home. She's leaving home rather than I'm leaving home. But then suddenly, at various points in the song, we hear the parents and their sorrow and their worry and their angst at the very fact that their daughter has gone, and they thought they were doing their best for her, but evidently it wasn't good enough, and all of that, and let's hope she's okay. There's so much about the Beatles to admire and to revel in and to wonder at, to be honest. But one thing that very rarely gets mentioned but is absolutely paramount throughout their recorded catalogue is the extraordinary backing vocals or harmony vocals that they gave to one another. Paul McCartney constantly, from start to finish, enhanced John Lennon's songs with the most fantastic harmony lines. And John, in turn, when required by Paul, would give beautifully harmony lines to Paul's songs. So, and Sgt. Pepper is full of the most glorious vocal harmonies, which in an album where there's so much to admire often gets overlooked, but really it's one of the crowning glories of the album is just how beautiful the vocalizing is from start to finish.
Friday morning at 9 o'clock, she is far away, waiting to keep the appointment she made, meeting a man from the motor trade. Gee, what did we do that was wrong? He's heavy. We didn't know it was wrong. Fun is the one thing that money can't buy. Something inside that was always denied.
Paul McCartney and John Lennon singing at the end of She's Leaving Home and finishing with that lovely bye-bye on an amen plagal cadence there. You're listening to The Music Show on RN. I'm talking to Beatles historian Mark Lewison on the occasion of the 50th birthday of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. 1967 was such an important year for the Beatles. I mean, Sgt. Pepper alone would have made it an important year. This album that came out at the beginning of the summer of love, and yet it contains no love songs. But it had begun with perhaps their greatest ever single, which was the double A side of Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever. And it ended with their first genuine disaster in the form of Magical Mystery Tour. And there was a fair bit more along the way, including the death of their manager, Brian Epstein. Would you say that this is essentially the most important year of the Beatles' whole existence, Mark?
I can see why you'd think that. Actually, every single year they were together was packed with incidents and turning point moments, because it was all condensed into, from the point of view of making records, 1962 to 69. So all of that happened, and their fame happened in that period. Though, as I say in Tune In, it had actually begun in some years earlier than that. But certainly in terms of the public eye, it was all happening in a very condensed period. So each year was remarkable in its own way. But 1967, yes, I do agree that it had so many elements to it which were significant. They were in reality, they were quite quiet whilst they were making this record. They made it from November 1966 through to about the middle of April 1967. And in that period of time, aside from releasing one double-sided single and a couple of films to go with it for TV showing, no one really heard much of them. They only burst back in June with this album and then with the single All You Need Is Love, which came out 3 weeks later. Imagine, as I said earlier, an album like this and then a single 3 weeks later that's not on the album.
Yes,
unbelievable,
right.
Then they take up with the Maharishi, then Brian Epstein dies, then they throw themselves into the making of Magical Mystery Tour, and then that comes out on British television on Boxing Day, December 26, 1967, and was slaughtered by the newspapers the following day. I don't personally subscribe at all to the notion of the project itself being a disaster. I think it's much more the case that the Fleet Street English newspapers the day after kind of set the tone for how that film would be remembered. But actually, I'm much more open-minded about its value. And actually, I think it's a fantastic piece of work for them to have done. But what they probably made a mistake here was get the way they put it out to the public. Had it been a little underground film in a late night arts cinema in London, it probably would have been extremely well received. But because it went out on mainstream television on a holiday with a family viewing audience, in black and white when it was made in color. These were bad decisions, which in the end kind of dogged the film's reception. But yes, it's 67 was an amazing year. It was the first full year after they gave up the live stage. What with that and what with the death of their manager, everything after 67 was heading downhill. Not necessarily musically, but in terms of their togetherness, it was certainly going the wrong direction by then.
Mark Lewison, thank you very much for being my guest again on The Music Show.
Thank you for having me.